rest of your life, Pennebaker told us. You can start and stop when you feel you need to. Labeling negative emotions makes them easier to deal with. The more specific the label, the better. I'm feeling lonely helps us process more than the vague, I'm feeling awful. By putting feelings into words, we give ourselves more power over them. In one study, people with a phobia of spiders learned they were going to interact with one. But first, the participants were instructed to distract themselves. Think of the spider as non-threatening, do nothing, or label their feelings about the spider. When the spider showed up, those who labeled their fear exhibited significantly less physiological arousal and were more willing to approach it. There are some caveats. Immediately after a tragedy or crisis, journaling can backfire. The event is too raw for some to process. After loss, it appears that writing can reduce loneliness and improve mood, but does not necessarily help with grief or depression symptoms. Still, for many, constructing a story can lead to insight. For those who don't enjoy writing, talking into a voice recorder works just as well. There seems to be less benefit to expressing trauma without language, through art, music, or dance. But at least there'll be no hurt feelings if your angry, abstract painting falls into the wrong hands. Journaling helped Catherine identify thoughts that were holding her back. Like, people will only love me when I have something to offer them. And, relying on other people makes me weak and needy. Psychologists call these self-limiting beliefs, and Catherine decided to replace them with what she calls self-freeing beliefs. She wrote, "My worth isn't tied to my actions, and I can allow other people to care for me, and I need to take care of myself." After a year of therapy, Catherine was ready to renew her commitment to helping people defy the odds and defy their pasts. Starting fresh in New York, she launched Defy Ventures, a program that provides current and former inmates with mentoring and training to start businesses. In one of the courses she created, students learn how to pinpoint their own self-limiting beliefs and rewrite them as self-freeing beliefs. This year, I had a chance to visit a prison with Catherine. I saw her help the inmates, entrepreneurs in training, as she calls them, define themselves by their future goals instead of their past traumas and mistakes. 6 years in, Catherine reports that Defy Ventures has aided more than 1,700 graduates and incubated and funded 160 startups, achieving a 95% employment rate with just 3% recidivism. Catherine regained her self-confidence not only professionally, but in her personal life, too. In 2013, she married Charles Hoke, who believed so strongly in the Defy mission that a year after their wedding, he left his job in finance to work with her. "I have my second chance as a wife. I have my second chance at life," Catherine said. "I have my second chance to extend second chances to others." Self-confidence is critical to happiness and success. When we lack it, we dwell on our flaws. We fail to embrace new challenges and learn new skills. We hesitate to take even a small risk that can lead to a big opportunity. We decide not to apply for a new job, and the promotion we miss becomes the moment our career stalled. We don't muster the courage to ask for a first date, and the future love of our life becomes the one who got away. Like many, I've struggled with self-doubt throughout my life. In college, every time I took an exam, I feared that I'd failed. And every time I didn't embarrass myself or even did well, I believed that I'd fooled my professors. I later learned that this phenomenon is called the imposter syndrome, and while both women and men feel it, women tend to experience it more intensely. Nearly 2 decades later, after seeing this same self-doubt hold back so many women at work, I gave a TED Talk that encouraged women to sit at the table. This talk became the basis for my book, Lean In. Researching and being open about how I'd grappled with insecurity helped me understand ways to build my self-confidence. As I urged other women to believe in themselves and act on what they would do if they weren't afraid, I learned these lessons myself. Then I lost Dave. When a loved one dies, we expect to be sad. We expect to be angry. What we don't see coming, or at least I didn't, is that trauma can also lead to self-doubt in all aspects of our lives. This loss of confidence is another symptom of pervasiveness. We are struggling in one area, and suddenly we stop believing in our capabilities in other areas. Primary loss triggers secondary losses. For me, my confidence crumbled overnight. It reminded me of watching a house in my neighborhood that had taken years to build get torn down in a matter of minutes. Boom. Flattened. My first day back in the office after Dave's death, Mark and I were in a meeting with the Facebook ads team. To illustrate a point, I turned to Boz, our head of product and engineering, and said, "You remember this from when we worked on it together at Google." It would have been a fine thing to say, except that Boz never worked with me at Google. He started his career at Google's then-rival, Microsoft. In the next meeting, I wanted to make sure I contributed something. Anything. Someone directed a question at a colleague, but I jumped in to answer. And went on and on. Somewhere in the middle, I realized I was rambling, but I kept going, unable to stop. Later that night, I called Mark to say that I knew I'd made a total fool of myself. Twice. That I remembered. "Don't worry," Mark said. "Thinking Boz worked at Google is the kind of mistake you would have made before." Very comforting. Actually, it was comforting. But even if I had made those kinds of mistakes before, now it was all I could focus on. Then Mark pointed out a few things I'd said in the meetings that he thought were on target, none of which I remembered. He went on to say that neither he nor anyone else expected me to be able to hold it together all the time. This comment helped me set more reasonable expectations and stop being so hard on myself. Mark's compassion started me down the path of learning to have compassion for myself. I felt deep gratitude for having such a supportive boss, and I know not everyone does. Many jobs don't even allow employees time off to grieve or care for their families. Compassion at work shouldn't be a luxury. It's important to develop policies that give people the time off and support they need, so we don't have to rely on the kindness of our bosses. Bolstered by Mark and a pep talk from my father that night, I returned to work the next day. And the next day. And the days after that. But on so many of those days, my grief prevented me from thinking clearly. In the middle of a meeting, an image of Dave's body on that gym floor would flash before my eyes. It was like augmented reality. I knew that I was in a Facebook conference room, but it felt like his body was there, too. Even when I was not seeing his image, I was crying constantly. Lean in, I could barely stand up. Journaling became a key part of my recovery. I began on the morning of Dave's funeral, 4 days after he died. "Today, I will bury my husband," was the first line I wrote. This is the unthinkable. I have no idea why I want to write all of this down, as if I could forget any detail. I had been trying to keep a journal since childhood. Every couple of years, I would start a new one, only to give up just a few days later. But over the 5 months following Dave's funeral, 106,338 words poured out of me. I felt like I couldn't breathe until I wrote everything down, from the smallest detail of my mourning to the unanswerable questions of existence. If I went even a few days without journaling, the emotions would build up inside me until I felt like a dam about to burst. At the time, I didn't understand why writing on an inanimate computer was so important. Shouldn't I be talking to my family and friends who could actually respond? Wouldn't it be better to try to distance myself from the anger and grief rather than use the limited time I had alone each day to dredge it all up? Now it's clear that my compulsion to write was guiding me in the right direction. Journaling helped me process my overwhelming feelings and my all too many regrets. I thought constantly about how if I'd known that Dave and I had only 11 years, I would have made sure we spent more time together. I wish that in the hard moments in our marriage we had fought less and understood each other more. I wish that on what turned out to be our last anniversary, I had stayed home rather than flying with my kids to attend a bar mitzvah. And I wished that when we went for a hike that final morning in Mexico, I'd walked by Dave's side and held his hand, instead of walking with Marnie while he walked with Phil. As I wrote out these moments, my anger and regret began to lessen. Philosopher Soren Kierkegaard said that life can only be understood backward, but it must be lived forward. Journaling helped me make sense of the past and rebuild my self-confidence to navigate the present and future. Then Adam suggested that I should also write down 3 things that I'd done well each day. At first, I was skeptical. I was barely functioning. What moments of success could I find? Got dressed today. Trophy, please. But there is evidence that these lists help by focusing us on what psychologists call small wins. In one experiment, people wrote down 3 things that went well and why every day for a week. Over the next 6 months, they became happier than a group writing about early memories. In a more recent study, people spent 5 to 10 minutes a day writing about things that went really well and why. Within 3 weeks, their stress levels dropped, as did their mental and physical health complaints. For 6 months, almost every night before I went to bed, I made my list. Since even the most basic tasks were hard, I started with those. Made tea. Got through all of my emails. Went to work and focused for most of one meeting. None of these were heroic accomplishments, but that little notebook by my bed served an important purpose. It made me realize that for my entire life, I'd gone to bed thinking about what I'd done wrong that day, how I'd messed up, what wasn't working. Just the act of reminding myself of anything that had gone well was a welcome shift. Making gratitude lists has helped me in the past, but this list served a different purpose. Adam and his colleague Jane Dutton found that counting our blessings doesn't boost our confidence or our effort, but counting our contributions can. Adam and Jane believe that this is because gratitude is passive. It makes us feel thankful for what we receive. Contributions are active. They build our confidence by reminding us that we can make a difference. I now encourage my friends and colleagues to write about what they have done well. The people who try it all come back with the same response. They wish they'd started doing this sooner. Slowly, I began to regain my self-confidence at work. I told myself the things I've told others who doubted themselves. I didn't have to aim for perfection. I didn't have to believe in myself all the time. I just had to believe I could contribute a little bit and then a little bit more. I'd experienced this phenomenon of incremental progress when I went skiing for the first time at age 16. To say that I am not a natural athlete is a serious understatement. On my 4th day on skis, my mother and I took a wrong turn and wound up on a difficult run. I looked down the mountain, panicked, and fell into the snow, knowing it would be impossible for me to get down alive. My mom told me not to look at the bottom, but instead just take 10 turns. She coaxed me to get up and then helped me count 10 turns out loud. After those 10 turns, I did another 10, then another. Eventually, I found my way to the bottom. Over the years, this lesson has stuck with me whenever I feel overwhelmed. What would you do if you weren't afraid? I'd take 1 turn, then another. As people saw me stumble at work, some of them tried to help by reducing pressure. When I messed up or was unable to contribute, they waved it off, saying, "How could you keep anything straight with all you're going through?" In the past, I had said similar things to colleagues who were struggling. But when people said it to me, I discovered that this expression of sympathy actually diminished my self-confidence even more. What helped was hearing, "Really? I thought you made a good point in that meeting and helped us make a better decision." Bless you. Empathy was nice, but encouragement was better. Self-doubt sneaks up even on those who see it coming. Adam's friend and fellow psychologist, Janessa Shapiro, was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer in her 30s. Her primary fear was dying, but her secondary fear was losing her job. While working on a paper, Janessa had trouble writing and immediately started wondering, "Are chemo and cancer destroying my ability to think?" As her productivity fell, she worried that she would be denied tenure and end up unemployed. She was also concerned about how others would view her. As an expert on stigma, she suspected that her cancer would make people doubt her capabilities. Janessa joined several colleagues to test this hypothesis, and sure enough, cancer survivors were less likely to get called back for job interviews. When she wasn't invited to give a presentation, she wondered, "Do people know I'm sick and don't want to bother me? Or do they think I'm not up to the challenge?" Janessa's husband helped her look at her situation with more self-compassion, reminding her, "When you didn't have cancer, you couldn't write a paper in a day." Her co-workers helped as well. As Janessa told us, "On the whole, people treat me like I am capable, someone who can still make valuable contributions. Of course, it is also stressful if people expect me to do everything that I did before, so I imagine it must be a difficult balancing act for my colleagues to hit the sweet spot between expecting too little and too much of me." Janessa's story and my experience have changed the way I interact with coworkers going through difficult personal situations. I still always start by offering them time off. But now I understand the importance of treating them as regular members of the team and praising their work as well. Janessa was thankful when she received tenure, but the fear of joblessness is widespread. Roughly 21 million Americans were fired or laid off from a job in 2015, down from nearly 27 million in 2009 at the height of the Great Recession. Anyone who's ever been fired, downsized, or forced to leave a job knows how devastating it can be. Not only does loss of income put people under tremendous financial pressure, it can also bring about secondary losses by triggering depression, anxiety, and other health problems. Losing a job is a blow to self-esteem and self-worth, and can rip away identities. By robbing people of a sense of control, losing income can actually lower their ability to tolerate physical pain. And the stress can spill over into personal relationships, resulting in increased conflict and tensions at home. To help people suffering from depression after job loss, psychologists at the University of Michigan held week-long workshops at churches, schools, libraries, and city halls. For 4 hours each morning, hundreds of unemployed people attended a program designed to build their job search confidence. They identified marketable skills and sources of job leads. They rehearsed interviews. They made a list of setbacks they might face and strategies for maintaining motivation. They found small wins. In the next 2 months, people who had participated in this program had a 20% greater chance of landing a new job. And for the next 2 years, they were more confident and more likely to stay employed. To be clear, no one is suggesting that self-confidence is a cure for unemployment. We need to provide education and support so people can find jobs and social insurance benefits to help them when they can't. But programs like this can make a difference. Self-confidence at work is important and often discussed, but self-confidence at home is just as crucial and often overlooked. Being a single parent was uncharted territory for me. Dave and I had always discussed even the smallest decisions concerning our children. I thought many times about how the night Dave died I had not even wanted to make a decision on my own about my son's ripped sneakers. Suddenly, Our decade-long conversation about parenting came to an abrupt stop. When I wrote Lean In, some people argued that I did not spend enough time writing about the difficulties women face when they don't have a partner. They were right. I didn't get it. I didn't get how hard it is to succeed at work when you are overwhelmed at home. I wrote a chapter titled, Make Your Partner a Real Partner, about the importance of couples splitting childcare and housework 50-50. Now I see how insensitive and unhelpful this was to so many single moms who live with 100-0. My understanding and expectation of what a family looks like has shifted closer to reality. Since the early 1970s, the number of single mothers in the United States has nearly doubled. Today, almost 30% of families with children are headed by a single parent, 84% of whom are women. I will never experience or fully understand the challenges many single moms face. Although the odds are stacked against them, they do everything they can to raise incredible children. To try to make ends meet, many have more than one job, not including the job of being a mother. And high-quality childcare is often prohibitively expensive. The costs of placing a 4-year-old and an infant in childcare exceed annual median rent payments in every state. Despite their hard work, single mothers have the highest rates of poverty in America and are almost twice as likely to be poor as single fathers. Families headed by Black and Latina single mothers face even more challenges, with poverty rates approaching 40%. Almost a third of single mothers and their children experience food insecurity. While we advocate for policy changes to support these families, we also need to do all we can to offer more immediate help. Shockingly, 1 in 3 families in the San Francisco Bay Area needs food assistance. I started volunteering years ago at my local food bank, Second Harvest, then helped launch the Stand Up for Kids campaign, which now provides meals to almost 90,000 kids every month. After the campaign began distributing food at a local charter school, student disciplinary problems decreased. "People thought we had bad kids," the principal told us, "but we had hungry kids." Another school reported that the program reduced student absenteeism and health complaints and increased academic performance. Working moms, especially those who are single, are put at a disadvantage from the start. The United States is the only developed country in the world that does not provide paid maternity leave. And many women and men don't have access to the sick and bereavement leave they need to get through difficult times, which makes it more likely that personal struggles will lead to work struggles. Adam's research has shown that this is short-sighted. Offering support through personal hardships helps employees become more committed to their companies. We need to rethink our public and corporate policies to make sure that women and men get the time off they need to care for themselves and their families. We also need to banish the outdated assumption that children live with 2 married heterosexual parents. Once Dave died, the world kept reminding me and my children of what we no longer had. From father-daughter dances to portfolio night at school, father-child events were everywhere. My brother David said that he too realized for the first time how many father events there were at their public school in Houston, and how hard that must be for the many children without dads. Judgment calls loomed before me, making me feel increasingly incapable. What would Dave have done? Day after day, I wished I knew and wished even more that he were here to answer the questions himself. But just like at work, when I focused on small steps, it was easier. I saw that I didn't have to know how to help my kids with every situation they would encounter. I didn't have to help them cope with a lifetime's worth of sadness every time they cried. I just had to help them with what they were facing right then. I did not have to take even 10 turns. I just had to help them take 1 turn at a time. I started by making a few decisions, then immediately questioned those decisions. Anything that seemed to violate Dave's preferences, no matter how small, rattled me. Dave believed that sleep was critically important for our children and adamantly opposed sleepovers. But after he passed away, I found that sleepovers comforted and distracted my kids. I knew this change was inconsequential, but it seemed symbolic to me of how hard it was to live without Dave and still honor his wishes. My sister-in-law Amy pointed out that Dave never got to tell me how his views would have evolved in the face of devastating loss. I could then picture him saying, "Yes, of course. If it makes them happier, they can have sleepovers." And while I'll never know what Dave would think about small decisions, like whether preteens can watch Pretty Little Liars or if it's okay for them to play Pokemon Go, I do know what he wanted for our kids more than a good night's sleep. Integrity. Curiosity. Kindness. Love. Without Dave as a rudder, I found myself relying heavily on feedback from friends and family. Like when colleagues pointed to something positive at work, it helped when friends let me know they thought I'd handled something well at home. It also helped when they were honest about how I could do things better, like suggesting I'd be more flexible with previous rules and more patient with both my children and myself. As I got farther from the trauma and the newness of life without Dave, I found myself journaling less. I no longer felt like I was going to burst without this outlet. The day after what would have been Dave's 48th birthday, I decided I had to try to move on from this phase of my mourning. I sat down and wrote this. October 3rd, 2015. This is the last entry of this journal. The longest 22.25 weeks, 156 days, I have ever lived. I am pushing myself to move onward and upward, and part of that is to stop writing this journal. I think I am ready. I dreaded yesterday since the day Dave died. I knew it would be a marker, the birthday that did not happen. Anytime anyone said it would be Dave's birthday, I corrected them in my mind and sometimes out loud. No, it will not be his birthday. You have to be alive to have a birthday. He is not. October 2nd, 2015 was the day he would have turned 48. 48 years old. Half a life. Went to his grave with Paula, Rob, Mom, Dad, David, and Michelle. It looked so much smaller than it loomed in my memory from the day we buried him. Towards the end of our time there, I sat down in front of the grave by myself. I spoke to him out loud. I told him that I loved him and that I missed him every minute of every day. I told him how empty the world seemed without him in it. And then I just cried, as it was so painfully clear that he could not hear me. David and Michelle gave me a few minutes alone and then came over and sat down next to me, one on each side. Something so comforting about this. I realized that my siblings were in my life long before Dave was. We talked about how if we were lucky, the three of us would live long enough to bury our parents, and we would do it there, together. And so life continues with them. Not with Dave, but with them. I can grow old with David and Michelle by my side as they always have been. Looking at Dave's grave, I realize that there is nothing left to do or say. I don't get to tell him I love him ever again. I don't get to hold him or kiss him ever again. I have learned how to make sure I talk about him constantly so our children remember him, but I will never again have another conversation with him about them. I can cry all day, every day, but it will not bring him back. Nothing will. We are all headed for where Dave is, without a doubt. Looking at the row upon row of headstones, it is so clear that we all end up in the ground. So each day has to count. I don't know how many I have left, and I want to start living again. I am not happy yet. But I know how much I have done these past 5 months. I know I can survive. I know I can raise my kids. I know I need a ton of help and have learned to ask for it. And I believe more and more that the core people are in this with me for the long haul. It is still scary, but less so. As all of them tell me over and over, I am not alone. We all need other people, and I do more than ever. But at the end of the day, the only person who can move my life ahead, make me happy, and build a new life for my kids is me. 156 days in. Hopefully many more to go. So today, I end this journal and try to restart the rest of my life. Chapter 5, Bouncing Forward. The one I become will catch me. In the depths of winter, I finally learned that within me there lay an invincible summer. Albert Camus. As a physician, Joe Casper devoted most of his career to treating patients with life-threatening illnesses. Still, when his teenage son Ryan was diagnosed with a rare and fatal form of epilepsy, he felt completely at a loss. In a few short moments, I learned my son's fate and there was nothing I could do about it. No hope for a cure, Joe wrote. It was like seeing my son tied to a railroad track with a locomotive right around the bend and having to look on in helpless frustration and despair. A traumatic experience is a seismic event that shakes our belief in a just world, robbing us of the sense that life is controllable, predictable, and meaningful. Yet Joe was determined not to get sucked into the void. When we are no longer able to change a situation, psychiatrist and Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl observed, we are challenged to change ourselves. After his son's diagnosis, Joe wanted to learn everything he could about recovery from trauma. His search led him to the work of UNC Charlotte professors Richard Tedeschi and Lawrence Calhoun. The two psychologists were treating grieving parents and expected to see signs of devastation and post-traumatic stress, which they did. But they also found something surprising. The parents were all suffering and would have done anything to bring their children back. At the same time, many also described some positive outcomes in their lives following loss. It seems hard to believe, but as time passed, instead of post-traumatic stress, some of the parents experienced post-traumatic growth. Psychologists went on to study hundreds of people who had endured all kinds of trauma. Victims of sexual assault and abuse, refugees and prisoners of war, and survivors of accidents, natural disasters, severe injuries, and illnesses. Many of these people experienced ongoing anxiety and depression. Still, along with these negative emotions, there were some positive changes. Up to that point, psychologists had focused mostly on two possible outcomes of trauma. Some people struggled. They developed PTSD, faced debilitating depression and anxiety, or had difficulty functioning. Others were resilient. They bounced back to their state before the trauma. Now there was a third possibility. People who suffered could bounce forward. Adam told me about post-traumatic growth 4 months after Dave died. It didn't sound real to me. Too catchphrasy. Too unlikely. Sure, there might be people who could grow from tragedy, so you could hold this out as hope to someone who had just lost her husband. But it wasn't going to happen for me. Adam understood my skepticism and admitted that he didn't even mention this possibility for the first few months because he knew I would dismiss it. But now he thought I was ready. He told me that more than half the people who experience a traumatic event report at least one positive change, compared to the less than 15% who develop PTSD. Then he did something super annoying. He quoted me to me. "You often argue that people can't be what they can't see," Adam said. "That girls aren't studying computer science because they don't see women in computer science. That women don't reach for leadership roles because they don't see enough women in leadership roles. This is the same thing. If you don't see that growth is possible, you're not going to find it." I agreed I would try to see it. And I had to admit that post-traumatic growth sounded a lot better than a life filled with sadness and anger. That's when I learned about Joe Casper. Tragically, his son Ryan died 3 years after the diagnosis, thrusting Joe into what he describes as the emotional tsunami of his death. If there is anything more painful in life, I hope never to discover it. Joe vowed not to let the tsunami pull him under. He decided to study positive psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, where Adam was one of his professors. Joe learned that post-traumatic growth could take 5 different forms: finding personal strength, gaining appreciation, forming deeper relationships, discovering more meaning in life, and seeing new possibilities. But Joe wanted to do more than study Tedeschi and Calhoun's findings. He wanted to live them. Nietzsche famously described personal strength as, "What does not kill me makes me stronger." Tedeschi and Calhoun have a slightly softer, one could say less Nietzschean, take. "I am more vulnerable than I thought, but much stronger than I ever imagined." When we face the slings and arrows of life, we are wounded and the scars stay with us. But we can walk away with greater internal resolve. "I can't imagine." People continued to say this to me, and I agreed with them. It was all I could do to live through the moments when it hurt so much. In the depths of acute grief, I did not think I would be capable of growing stronger. But as excruciating days turned into weeks and then months, I realized that I could imagine because I was living it. I had gained strength just by surviving. In the words of an old adage, "Let me fall if I must fall. The one I become will catch me." Slowly, very slowly, a new sense of perspective began seeping into my daily life. In the past, when my children faced challenges, I would get anxious and Dave would reassure me. Now it is up to me to stay calm on my own. Before, if my daughter came home upset that she didn't make the soccer team with her friends, I would have encouraged her to keep practicing while secretly worrying that she was disappointed. Now I think, "This is great! A normal kid problem! What a relief to be in a normal problem zone!" Note to self: think these thoughts, but do not say them out loud. My childhood friend Brooke Pallett endured an arduous adoption process filled with huge disappointments, which melted away when she finally held her baby. In the happy months that followed, Brooke met Meredith, another new mom. Meredith had struggled to get pregnant, and the two women bonded over their miracle babies. The kids connected too, becoming what Brooke called little baby besties. Then one day, Meredith found a small lump under her armpit. She was only 34 and felt perfectly healthy, but had it checked anyway. A PET scan revealed that she had stage 4 breast cancer. In addition to offering Meredith her full support, Brooke felt compelled to get her own mammogram. When she tried to schedule it, her gynecologist's office advised her to wait half a year until she turned 40 and insurance would cover the cost. But Brooke insisted on the test, which revealed that she had stage 4 breast cancer too. The two friends went through chemotherapy together. Brooke responded to the treatment, but Meredith's cancer had already spread to her liver. She died 3 years later. "I always tell her parents, her husband, and her daughter that she was my angel," Brooke now says. "What saved me is that they caught my cancer before it had gone to any vital organs. And that is because of Meredith." Brooke has been in remission for 7 years, and in addition to gaining physical strength, she has gained emotional strength. "I went through chemo and buried my young friend." That gives you perspective, whether you're looking for it or not. "The little things don't stress me out. I am much stronger, much more centered, and reasonable now. Something that sent me spinning before, I now see as relative to what could have been, and I'm like, ah, that's nothing. I am here." This is the second area of post-traumatic growth that Tedeschi and Calhoun identified. Gaining appreciation. In the first month after Dave died, I received an amazingly supportive call from Kevin Krim. Kevin and I had only met in passing, but we had close friends in common, and I knew he had suffered an unthinkable tragedy. In 2012, after a swimming lesson with their 3-year-old daughter, Nessie, Kevin's wife, Marina, returned to their New York apartment to find that their nanny had stabbed their 6-year-old daughter, Lulu, and their 2-year-old son, Leo, to death. When I saw Kevin months after his loss, I could barely speak, not knowing what, if anything, to say. Now he was calling to comfort me. I asked Kevin how in the world he had gotten through it. He told me that in his eulogy, he explained, "I worry that we might be tempted, in the face of such obliterating darkness, to retreat from the world. But I heard this quote that I think is very important here. It goes, 'He who has a why to live for can bear almost any how.'" Marina and Nessie, you are my why. Kevin told me how grateful he felt that his daughter had survived and his marriage was strong. He and Marina decided to have more children, and they felt fortunate that they were able to. Since Lulu and Leo loved art, Kevin and Marina started ChooseCreativity.org, a nonprofit that teaches creativity to disadvantaged children. Kevin and Marina are finding post-traumatic growth by adding more love and beauty to the world, which is an act of love and beauty itself. It is the irony of all ironies to experience tragedy and come out of it feeling more grateful. Since I lost Dave, I have at my fingertips this unbelievable reservoir of sadness. It's right next to me where I can touch it, part of my daily life. But alongside that sadness, I have a much deeper appreciation for what I used to take for granted. Family, friends, and simply being alive. My mom offered a helpful comparison. For 66 years, she never thought twice about walking. But as she aged, her hip deteriorated and walking became painful. After hip replacement surgery 4 years ago, she feels grateful for every step she is able to take without pain. What she feels on a physical level, I feel on an emotional level. On the days that I'm okay, I now appreciate that I'm walking without pain. There were times when I'd felt this appreciation before. After college, I worked for the World Bank's India Health Team on leprosy eradication. I visited treatment centers and hospitals all over India and met hundreds of patients, many of whom had been kicked out of their villages and were living in abject poverty and isolation. My first trip lasted a month. I got through each day trying to be professional and then cried myself to sleep each night. It put all of my problems into perspective. I remember thinking that I would never complain about anything in my life again. I would appreciate my good fortune to be born into a community with the resources to invest in healthcare. But over the years, that perspective faded and life went back to how it was before. Now I'm determined to hold on to this gratitude. When I asked Brooke how she does it, she said she reminds herself regularly of what she could have lost. "I'm watching Meredith's daughter grow up and trying to be present in her life in every way that I can. Each time I look at my little girl, I remember that my friend isn't here to raise her daughter. I know how lucky I am." Brooke makes a conscious effort to mark the milestones. "Every year I celebrate that I got another year with my daughter," Brooke told me. "7 years ago, I didn't think I would see her second birthday." After loss, the emptiness of birthdays, anniversaries, and holidays can be especially hard. Brooke encouraged me to see these milestones as moments to be cherished. "I used to celebrate my birthday every 5 years, feeling like only the birthdays with the zeros and fives were special occasions. Now I celebrate every one because I no longer take for granted that the next birthday will come. Long gone are the jokes I used to make about not wanting to grow old, and working for a boss who is 15 years my junior, I used to make those jokes a lot." After we lost Dave, my friend Katie Middick started writing letters to her friends on their birthdays, letting them know how much they mean to her. Some of her friends have followed her lead, showing pre-traumatic growth. They learned lessons in life that I learned only from death. Last fall, Malala Yousafzai and her father, Zaihuddin, came to my house to discuss her work fighting for all girls to have access to education. They stayed for dinner with Katie, her husband Scott, and my kids, and we all went around the table to share our best, worst, and grateful moments of the day. Scott said that he had spent the past week worried about how one of their children was adjusting to a new school, but listening to Malala reminded him how grateful he should be that his kids have a school to attend. Malala then shared her own gratitude story. She told us that after she was shot by the Taliban, her mother started giving her birthday cards dated from the beginning of her recovery. When Malala turned 19, the card said, "Happy 4th birthday." Her mother was reminding her daughter and herself that Malala was lucky to be alive. We don't have to wait for special occasions to feel and show gratitude. In one of my favorite studies, people were asked to write and deliver a thank you note to someone who had shown them unusual kindness. This pleased the receivers, but it also made the note writers feel significantly less depressed, and the gratitude afterglow stayed with them for a month. When Adam shared this research with me, I realized why it works. In the moments I spend thanking my friends and family, my sadness is pushed into the background. My friend Stephen Levitt lost his 1-year-old son Andrew to meningitis in 1999. 16 years later, he told me that, with each passing year, the balance tipped a little more toward an appreciation of what there once was and away from the horror of what was lost. As time has passed, I too have greater appreciation for the time Dave and I spent together and for the time I have now. 11 days before the anniversary of his death, I broke down crying to a friend. We were sitting, of all places, on a bathroom floor. I said, 11 days? 1 year ago, he had 11 days left, and he had no idea. Looking at each other through tears, we asked how he would have lived if he had known he had only 11 days left, and if we could live going forward with the understanding of how precious every single day is. Tragedy does not always leave us appreciating the people in our lives. Trauma can make us wary of others and have lasting negative effects on our ability to form relationships. Many survivors of sexual abuse and assault report that their beliefs about the goodness of others remain shattered, and they have difficulty trusting people. After losing a child, parents often have a harder time getting along with relatives and neighbors. After losing a spouse, it's common for people to argue more with friends and feel insulted by them. But tragedy can also motivate people to develop new and deeper relationships. This is a third area of post-traumatic growth. Soldiers who experience significant losses during war are more likely to have friendships from their service 40 years later. After heavy combat, they value life more and prefer to spend their time with people who share that understanding. Many breast cancer survivors report feeling greater intimacy with family and friends. When people endure tragedies together or endure the same tragedy, it can fortify the bonds between them. They learn to trust each other, be vulnerable with each other, depend on each other. As the saying goes, in prosperity, our friends know us. In adversity, we know our friends. One of the most striking examples of how adversity can drive people to build stronger connections is Stephen Thompson. Growing up, he and his 4 younger siblings were frequently homeless, sleeping in shelters and cars. His mother struggled with severe drug and alcohol problems, and the family often went hungry, sometimes stealing food from local grocery stores. Stephen had to take care of his siblings and missed so much school that he fell behind. His teachers assumed he had learning disabilities and placed him in special education classes. Once, while he was living with his grandmother, a SWAT team came looking for his mom, who hid behind a door. A policeman later explained that she and her boyfriend had blown up a bridge during a political protest. When Stephen was 9 years old, his mother abandoned him and his siblings in a hotel room. It took 3 days before Child Protective Services found them. This turned out to be the bottom that Stephen was able to kick against to start his rise to the surface. "Our lives before were unbearably stressful," he said. "When she left us in that hotel, it was almost a gift. A new beginning for us." Stephen believes that his resilience came from learning at a young age to view this extreme trauma as a chance to form new relationships. He spent a few months in a foster home on a street near his siblings and was then sent to live in a state home for children. Once he started going to school regularly, he was able to form stable friendships. His new friends invited him over for Thanksgiving and Christmas, and he had the chance to celebrate the holidays with their families. Then the mother of a close friend changed everything by asking Stephen to live with them permanently. "It was one of the most powerful lessons of my life, because it really showed me the kindness of others," Stephen told us. "I realized that friends can become your family." He made a pact with himself to always be there for his friends, to call at tough times, to really try and connect with people and get to know them. "I got to know Stephen when we worked together at Google, where he turned his remarkable ability for connecting with people into a career as an executive recruiter." The fourth form of post-traumatic growth is finding greater meaning in life. A stronger sense of purpose rooted in a belief that one's existence has significance. In Viktor Frankl's words, "In some way, suffering ceases to be suffering at the moment it finds a meaning." Many find meaning in discovering religion or embracing spirituality. Traumatic experiences can lead to deeper faith, and people with strong religious and spiritual beliefs show greater resilience and post-traumatic growth. Rabbi J. Moses, who officiated at my and Dave's wedding, told me that finding God or a higher power reminds us that we are not the center of the universe. There is much we don't understand about human existence, and there is order and purpose to it anyway. It helps us feel that our suffering is not random or meaningless. Yet that suffering can also test our faith in God's benevolence. Laverne Williams, a church deacon from Montclair, New Jersey, told us that when she was struggling with depression and her sister was diagnosed with cancer, she questioned God. "There are times when I've been angry at God. How can you let this happen?" she said. But then she remembered that it's not about praying to God to fix everything. He's not a magic genie where you can ask for certain things and only the good things pop out. Still, her faith helped her reject permanence. "Even when you are in the darkest hours, you can stay hopeful. That's the thing about faith. It helps you know that sooner or later, this too shall pass." Last spring, I read an open letter from NFL veteran Vernon Turner to his younger self. The letter graphically described how he was conceived. His mother was an 18-year-old track star who was attacked on the street, injected with heroin, and gang-raped. When Vernon was 11 years old, he walked in on his mother shooting heroin in their bathroom. Instead of sending him out, she said, "I want you to see me do this because I don't ever want you to do this. Because this is going to kill me." 4 years later, her words proved tragically true. At first, a stepfather took care of Vernon and his four younger siblings. But during Vernon's freshman year of college, his stepfather passed away too. Not even 20 years old, Vernon was solely responsible for his family. "I was so moved by the letter that I reached out to him. Vernon explained to me that at that point, he hit rock bottom." He wrote, "I thought I was being punished. First God took my mom, then my dad. Now I was going to lose my family. I got on my knees and prayed. I asked God to show me how to help my family. Vernon thought the only way he could earn enough money to provide for them was to play in the NFL. He was a star for a Division II college team, but had been told repeatedly that he wasn't tall enough, strong enough, or talented enough to turn pro. He wrote, "I had to make it, because if I didn't, my brothers and sisters would be in foster care. I was not going to be a product of my DNA. I was going to be a product of my actions." Vernon was driven by a clear purpose. He began setting his alarm for 2 a.m. to start his workouts, building strength by tying a rope around his body and dragging a tire up a hill. "I pushed myself to the limit mentally and physically. I put myself through brutal hell preparing for the NFL. I had workouts I would not wish on my worst enemy. I was ready to die on the football field." He made it into the league as a return specialist. "What triggered resilience for me," he said, "was God giving me strength and my mom telling me, right before she died, that no matter what happens, you keep the family together. I turned to football to save my family. When they measured my stature, they failed to measure my heart." Family and religion are the greatest sources of meaning for many people. But work can be another source of purpose. The jobs where people find the most meaning are often ones that serve others. The roles of clergy, nurses, firefighters, addiction counselors, and kindergarten teachers can be stressful, but we rely on these often undercompensated professionals for health and safety, learning and growth. Adam has published 5 different studies demonstrating that meaningful work buffers against burnout. In companies, nonprofits, government, and the military, he finds that the more people believe their jobs help others, the less emotionally exhausted they feel at work and the less depressed they feel in life. And on days when people think they've had a meaningful impact on others at work, they feel more energized at home and more capable of dealing with difficult situations. "After Dave's death, my work became more meaningful to me. I connected with the Facebook mission of helping people share in a way that I never had before. In 2009, my friend Kim Jabal's brother died by suicide on his 40th birthday. Suffering from shock, her family didn't think they could handle a memorial service. But people wanted to share their stories, to support us, and to support each other," Kim told me at the time. "They did it on Facebook. An outpouring of love and support came through. Every day we would read more stories, see more photos, learn about someone else who knew him and loved him. The same thing happened for me. I did not truly understand how important Facebook could be to those suffering from loss until I experienced it myself." During his eulogy for Dave, our friend Xander Lurie was describing Dave's generosity when he stopped mid-sentence and did something that none of us had ever seen before at a funeral. He asked everyone to raise your hand if Dave Goldberg did something to change your life for the better, provided a key insight, a valuable connection, help when you were down. "I looked behind me and saw hundreds of arms shooting into the air. There was no way to hear all those stories that day, and even if I had, I was in no state to remember them. But many are now preserved on Dave's Facebook profile. Person after person, some with names I'd never heard, shared how Dave took time to help them get a job, start a business, support a cause. Our friend Steve Filer posted a video of Dave cheering at a baseball game and wrote, 'Dave reminded me how good it feels to cheer and to be cheered for. He made me feel in the moment.' In Silicon Valley, where what's next trumps what's now, it's rare to be as warm and present as Dave. For those who have the opportunity, pursuing meaningful work can help with recovery from trauma. When my friend Jeff Huber lost his wife to colon cancer, I passed along what many had told me. Don't make any big decisions in the early stages of acute grief. Fortunately, Jeff ignored my advice. He quit his job to become CEO of Grail, a company that aims to detect cancer in its earliest phases.
It's like you've been through a portal, Jeff told me. You can't go back. You're going to change. The only question